All right, and welcome back, everybody. It's Thursday night here in America, Friday morning early in Scotland, Ireland, and the UK. This is Giving Children Hope with Donna Ferris and Tanis. So welcome to the show again, ladies.
Donna? Hi, Stephen. Thank you.
Tanis?
Hi. Hi, thank you for having us back on the show. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to give all of our children a voice tonight. And I want to say hi to everyone in Scotland, Ireland, the UK, and the US that are listening in.
Yes, welcome everyone. So go ahead and intro our guest tonight then, Donna.
Okay, Grandma, and tell everybody that we also have Sam Grizzini-Rucki on the line with us from Minnesota, along with her attorney, Michelle McDonald. Welcome, ladies.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us on.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you so much. Tanis, did you want to do what kind of following the pattern that we started last week and kind of just open this show up with a scripture?
Yes, because Dawn and I are, I believe that this is God's work. I mean, not that the persecution that's happening to us women and mothers and our children, but that God is working through those of us that are working hard to right this wrong, to bring about true justice, and we're so glad, Michelle, that you're one of those warriors that is coming from the system, because there's so few willing to stand up for us and our children. And I have many passages that speak to me, but I'll just read from this one, Matthew 10:26-28. Then do not be afraid of them, for nothing that is covered up that will not, there is nothing that is covered up that will not be brought into the light. There is nothing hid that will not be made known. You tell in the light what I have told you in the dark. You must speak in a loud voice from the roof of the houses what you have heard.
Amen. That's so true. I mean, especially covering the topic that we're going to discuss tonight, these custody kidnappings. So thank you so much for that, Tanis.
You're welcome.
Now, if you don't mind, we've talked previously, our guests, Sam and Michelle and Tanis and I and Stephen, and what we want to do is take the first part of this show and just really try to describe what this is that's going on. We want to put it out there almost on a systematic type level. This is an actual protocol that has been set in place. So we want to take some time to do that and then maybe get into more of the, all three of us, Sam, Tanis, and I, have our own personal custody cases. And you'll be able, we're hoping we can show you how it's done and the correlation among each case, the differences, but there's very few. It's a set protocol being used. Does that sound like a good way to start?
Yep, that sounds good to me.
All right. now, first, just so, just to give everybody an idea of what we're talking about, because this has multiple terms. It's been called court-licensed custody kidnapping, court-licensed child abuse, court-ordered child abuse, court-licensed abuse. There's multiple names for this, and it's one thing and one thing only. It is custody kidnapping. It's a set protocol in place to traffic our children. There's different ways that it can also be called kids for cash or pay to play. It's typically the thing that typically starts this kind of a case. And now I want to first differentiate between a civil divorce case in this type of case that I'm talking about, a custody kidnapping case. When it's a custody kidnapping case, there is no civil about it. This is a criminal, to even take the word divorce out of there, is a criminal case where there is a child trapped in the middle of it, a helpless, defenseless child. These cases that I'm talking about, differentiate from a civil divorce case in the fact that those two parents, God bless their hearts, they're able to have a peaceful divorce. They're able to put their differences aside and focus on their children. These type of cases have criminal elements to it that by law are criminal in nature, and the perpetrator needs to be punished, needs to be tried, convicted, and punished for these acts. Child abuse is by law criminal and crime in nature, and this type of child abuse is one of the severest forms because the children in these types of cases are not even viewed as being a human being. These children are used as pawns. Their fates are paid for. Their lives are paid for and bought. There's domestic violence involved, which is usually the trigger. Either the domestic violence or the child has disclosed some sort of child abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, any type of abuse that's dangerous and criminal in nature, and it's prompted what has been termed a protective parent, or I like to call a loving parent, to go to a family law courthouse, because by law, that's where you can go to get a protection from abuse order, or also you would go to, if you're doing in the middle of a divorce case and allegations of child abuse come forward, it stays handled within a family law courthouse versus, again, going to a criminal courthouse. So I just wanted to distinguish what type of cases we're talking about. These are cases where there is criminal elements, child abuse, violence, threats, state, local, state, and federal laws are violated. It's a criminal that is hiding under the disguise of a parent. And it, like I was saying, it forces the loving parent that is believing their child and taking these disclosures of child abuse seriously, go to the courthouse in one form or another, a family law courthouse, to seek protection for themselves and for their children, or just on behalf of their children. Regardless, they're seeking protection, and that's when this protocol begins. These criminals are almost identified immediately in the family law courthouse. I'll say a little bit more before I get into that, but basically what they are doing, and if they can find the right connections with the right attorneys or the right judges or the right family connections, or they've got the money, it doesn't matter. This protocol is open to anybody, a father or a mother, grandfather, grandmother, anybody can do it. Anybody can tap into this protocol. what they do is, when there's any allegations of child abuse or violence and threats, danger, things like that, the perpetrator involved uses our family law courts to avoid criminal punishment. And they're able to do it by buying custody of the child. And then everything, all of the evidence of the child abuse, the disclosures, any type of recordings, videotapes, everything, medical records, hospital reports, specialist reports, anything, it gets buried, covered up. The loving parent that ran to the courthouse initially for help gets discredited severely. They can take so many nasty allegations and just pile them on you till your head is swirling and you don't know which direction you're going. And within a moment's notice from that parent running to a courthouse for protection, it can happen even up to even within a day, that the judge that was hired can order that sole custody be given to the abuser. You've got a protective, loving parent that believed their child and is now being swirled and labeled and discredited and attacked viciously by nasty allegations, which is done on purpose. It's done on purpose to just destroy that parent emotionally, physically, in every which way you can possibly think. It's done to destroy that parent's ability to fight, destroy their willpower, take everything that they've got, because at that point, when you now have to hand over custody of your child to the abuser, because you know in your heart, you know yourself that this is happening, you've seen the medical reports yourself that abuser sexually molested that child, and the evidence is sitting right there. You believe your child, you've held your child, and many, many nights of sobbing and shaking, and you have to now hand this child over to that abuser. Meanwhile, dealing with God knows how many allegations, and you're doing this alone. Your children, on the other hand, they have no idea what's going on, and they're affected differently, of course, given their ages. And the first thing they know is they're letting someone know, whoever it was, and typically the parent, the safe, loving parent. The first thing they know, they're disclosing this abuse that can be, just dangerous, violent temper, outbursts, rages by a dangerous parent to sexual abuse, rape. And they've told the parent, and then the next thing they know, they have to go live with that other parent. And the courts take it a step further. The perpetrators take it a step further, because the first thing that happens when the custody of the child is bought and paid for and that child is handed over to the abuser, then it's an open paradise for the abuser in the courts to finish tearing that loving parent apart. So I already mentioned how you have to deal with just the trauma, the emotional trauma, and horror and devastation of having your child ripped out of your arms and actually having to hand your child over or face imprisonment or psychiatric hospitalization. You face outcast from society, from your family, from your friends, because no one can understand this and no one believes it. And then they believe maybe this about, well, if she or he had custody removed from them, then they must be a bad parent, because that's the myth that's perpetuated throughout society. So this person, this protective, loving parent, is no longer almost able to even stand up at this point, because you're truly standing alone. And then your child, you have to consider what that child is going through. That child is now forced to live in the arms of a very dangerous abuser. You know, children believe they have monsters under their bed. Well, in a court-ordered kidnapping to hide criminals, these monsters are right there in their room, in their beds. You know, they're right there. And so just imagine these children are crying, screaming, and praying to God, where did my mother go that I initially told about him? Or where did my father go? And I told him about my mother. They have no idea about the multiple court hearings. That's another part of this protocol. The more court hearings there are, the more chaos and confusion and burying of evidence. So it's done on purpose. It also is done to further destroy the loving parent's ability to withstand all that they're enduring. It's done to do that on purpose, is to weaken the soul and spirit of the parent that needs to fight for that child. So kids don't know that this is happening. Kids that are isolated, as soon as their lives are bought and paid for, and a judge signs this court order and puts them into the arms of the abusers, our children have no idea at that point what is coming of their world. They screamed, and God bless their hearts, children still scream. My sons continued screaming. I can't even tell you how long. The last I knew, it was at least a couple days before the last time I saw them. My son screamed out, just about a few days before the last time I saw them, and that was January 5th, 2012. So I knew even as of then, and they were kidnapped months earlier, I knew then that my children were still screaming. So children continue to scream about abuse and injustice, and again, depending on their ages, but they have no idea why nobody's listening. They have no idea why nobody's coming to help them. And again, they're just crying, praying for their loving parent. Where did that loving parent go? which brings me to the next part of this protocol. Now that that those involved in this court kidnapping and trafficking of our children have taken sole custody, given it to the abuser, they've destroyed the loving parent as much as they possibly can think to destroy emotionally, mentally, physically, because this just kills you. Then they begin, even further. You know, it's more, at that point, they got to cover up all that they've done. They've got to cover, they're now seeing that this protective loving parent isn't going away, which, by the way, is another part of this protocol that is the biggest red flag for me, and that tells me when it was a custody kidnapping. In my own professional work, was the protective parent never stops fighting. You can throw anything at a loving parent. You can just destroy them emotionally, mentally, physically, any possible way you can, and they're not gonna stop. They're gonna keep fighting, and they're gonna keep screaming, and they're gonna keep doing it in the names of their child that's been trapped. Getting back to that, so what the courts have to do to cover this up is they have to erase that loving, protective parent out of that child's life. Sometimes it's a slow process. It could involve where the court gives that loving parent what's called supervised visitation. Maybe you get an hour a week. Maybe your court ordered 20 hours a week, but for some reason you can't get more than 2 hours a week, and you better pay at least $100 an hour or more, or you're not going to see your child, and then you've got like a million different rules and regulations you have to follow during that entire time that you're with your child and your child is in your presence. And then it goes from they're going to use those supervised visits and they're going to hang them over that loving parent's head, because if you mess up even once, you're done. No more supervised visits. And then it goes from even no more supervised visits to you're done at all. You're left wondering where your child is, if your child's alive. Your child is still lingering at home, crying, praying, screaming, trying to survive and live with this dangerous abuser and wondering where you are. In my own particular case, it's been now over 2 years and 7 months, just over 2 years and 7 months since they have been kidnapped. And the last time I've seen them was 2 years, 7 months, and one day ago was the last time I've seen my children or knew if they were alive, Matthew and Donovan. On the other hand, my children have no idea if I am. The last thing they knew is they were telling everybody about their father almost killing Matthew, our oldest son, in front of our youngest son. So the children are the reason for this show tonight. There's a lot more to this protocol, which I'm sure Tienes can help jump in on here in a few minutes. But I want to just say that this is the reason for this show, giving children hope. It's these children, and it's what this does to them. Because, yes, the loving, protective parent is being destroyed on all levels possible and left homeless in almost every single case, left childless, and left completely penniless. But they continue fighting and fight hard and for years for someone, anyone to listen. And it's not even for anyone just to listen to them, but to listen to their children. Hear their children's screams. So this Giving Children Hope show tonight is exactly what I want to do. We have children of all ages that are missing, where they've been moved around once the pedophile, because that's the biggest part of this child trafficking ring, is pedophiles are being given sole custody of children. Children are being moved around. I can't even remember the latest numbers from when we had Connie Valentine and Karen Anderson on, but then we're talking in the millions of kids that are missing at this point. This tells you the extent of this trafficking. Years ago, there was a study, and I can't quite remember if it was called the Saunders study, and I apologize to Barry Goldstein and Saunders, but at the time, I believe the data stated it was about 58,000 children a year were being kidnapped, custody kidnapped. And that was years ago, and now you multiply that. We're talking over a million children that are being kidnapped through this protocol. And this isn't just in the United States. I've been just kind of describing a general format of this protocol. This is happening all over the world. Just in the little time that I've been trying to outreach and find other loving parents that have had their child kidnapped, there's a huge number of loving parents in Argentina, Australia, the UK, in Ireland even. That's why I'm just very excited that we have the Ireland broadcast at this point. This is happening all over the world. And it's a set form that they're doing it to our children who are left in the arms of the abusers, who are court-ordered into these homes. These are the ones that I want to reach out to. They are destroyed. They're destroyed beyond what I described a loving, protective parent. You know, I can't even take a moment to try to imagine the devastation for my own sons. Because when I do, I can't even breathe. You know, children are, they don't know about the court hearings. They don't know where that loving parent went. They don't know. They have no idea. They lose hope. You know, we're adults. We can at least have formed some sort of understanding of our children's lives being bought, but our children have none. They don't see justice. They see police officers who they idolize turn away, send them back. You know, who they went to scream to for help. They see teachers who try to help, but then they don't hear anything again. So should they go back to that teacher again? You know, they just lose hope, and they just get so silenced because once their lives are bought, they're left in prison. They're left in solitary confinement in prison, and it doesn't matter how long they scream, God bless their hearts, God bless the hearts of my own children. They screamed, and they screamed a long time. But it doesn't matter because from the very beginning, when their lives were bought in our family law courts, they were silenced. That was never, ever meant for them to ever be heard. So our children then are left becoming suicidal, becoming homicidal. You know, the anger, their own violence and rage inside of them for not seeing any justice, no one listening. They've run away. They feel safer being out on the streets in 20 below zero, trying to find a place to sleep at 14 years old, not knowing a soul and being terrified of every single monster around them. You know, but they'd rather be out on the streets, not knowing where anybody is and not having a single friend in the world, than being left in that court-ordered abusive home.
Yes. Michelle.
Did you ask me a question?
Do you have your Skype chat open?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Do you have your Skype chat open?
Skype chat. So let me see what would that be.
If you know how to do that. I think Donna...
Teaching me.
Are you ready to... I don't know. Are you still going, Donna?
I just have
Skype chat. Oh, shoot. I see what you mean.
Right. I just have a little bit more, and then Tianis has a part that I kind of would like her to mention. So if we can just hold off for 1 second.
Sure.
Okay. I want to also talk a little bit about these court orders, because when this is a custody kidnapping, a domestic violence, child abuse, you know, trying to hide those criminal elements. The court orders that you're going to find, they favor the abuser. And the words you'll find throughout these court orders when describing the loving parent, they can consist of words such as parental alienation, that parent is just crazy, insane, brainwashing the children, an alcoholic, a drug addict, a prostitute, they're just psychotic, delusional, suicidal, they're an imminent dangerous threat to their child, overly protected, almost neurotic, and the list can go on and on and on. The court orders, in those same court orders, the words that you're going to find of the abusive, dangerous parent are just going to be words that parent is like the golden child of all parents. You're not going to find, you'll find reference to the allegations of the violence and abuse, but that'll all be covered up by how that's just the golden child. One other important thing to note that I just want to mention is that the true victim to this, to the domestic violence, the child abuse, will almost never falsely report abuse, violence, and threats. The courts and perpetrators have encouraged the myth throughout our society that the true victim is making false claims and alienating the perpetrator from their child, when the opposite is almost always true. The violence is there, it is just covered up. A red flag that this is turning into domestic violence, the custody kidnapping protocol, is when the courts use the words such as alienating and brainwashing the children. The other parent is just spiteful, vindictive, that mean to use his or her children against him or her, a threat to his or her child, and again, the list can go on. This is when a closer look needs to be taken into those claims of abuse, violence, and threats, and not the opposite, which right now, the opposite is to rip those children away from the parent trying to protect them and put them right into the arms of their abuser. Again, I just want to mention that this, in my mind, is one of the most serious forms of child abuse with many devastating consequences. All children that are victims of this type of kidnapping and child trafficking end up with serious, lifelong, mental, emotional, psychological, and physical issues throughout their life as a result, if they survive at all. These children are ordered into the arms of their abusers, and it doesn't matter how long and how hard a loving parent or their family or anyone fights, they are ordered there until at least 18 years old. Because, as I said, they've got to cover this up. They've got to hide the level of corruption. They've got to erase the other parent from their life. You can go to court repeatedly. You can go for one appeal after another, and it's not going to make a difference. This is a form of corruption. It's a form of buying our children's lives. All of the children that are victims of this, that end up with these serious lifelong issues, if they survive. I mean, we're talking, they're in the... Did someone hang up?
I lost Tannis. Go ahead, Donna.
Okay. Well, should we try to get her back on the line first?
I am.
Oh, okay.
No, something's wrong. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, what I was saying is, you know, if they survive at all, because imagine they're living with these dangerous criminals that are seriously abusing them.
Oh. Hello?
Hi, Tannis.
Hi. Hi, we went off the air?
No. I lost you for some reason.
I lost me? Okay. It just got cut off. I don't know why.
Yeah, it did.
Okay. I missed the last part then, but that's all right.
We were just waiting for you to come back. The last thing I was saying, I was talking about the serious lifelong destruction and devastation to our children. And I just wanted to add, you know, the last part, that this is a generational thing. This isn't something, you know, that has just started in the last few years. You know, we've now, on the Giving Children Hope show, we've had Eileen King on. Someone's breathing in. Oh. We've had Eileen King from Child Justice Incorporated on, Karen Anderson and Connie Valentine from California Protective Parents Association. We've had Cindy Dumas from Safe Kids International and her son Damon, who last year at 16 years old had to actually get married and use a law in place for an adult to escape his abusive court-ordered home. And as we found out just from these shows alone, the extent of this has gone on for years, and what it has done in our society, and this is what I'm hoping to do tonight in raising public awareness, is we are left with serious, dangerous criminals hiding in our society for generations. That are hiding under the disguise of a parent and are able to do so by accessing and buying our children in our custody courts. So I wanted to add that in because the public needs to be aware that even the very next door neighbor could be a convicted child sex offender who has bought custody of a child to hide the, you know, any criminal punishment or anything. I just want to add one more thing before we kind of start talking more on our cases and how they draw together. Here in the state of Maine, I've already mentioned my own custody kidnapping case where my ex-husband, who's a fire chief, he bought our sons, custody of our sons, Matthew and Donovan, to avoid attempted murder on a child. He was never arrested, never set foot in a squad car, a jail, police station, nothing for it, because he went right to our family law courts, and he knew the right people because he comes from a family law firm, Ferris Law in Gardner, Maine. And he was able to have the right connections and buy custody of him, and the investigation into attempted murder on our son was dropped and never looked into again. Our sons weren't even interviewed by a detective, and he put our son in the hospital for 8 days with a dual traumatic brain injury with months of rehabilitative therapies. There's another custody case here in the state of Maine that connects to my case. And in which there's a little girl, her name is Mila. She's currently in the South Portland area. She's in the custody of her father, who is an illegal alien. There's an active deportation status out on him, where it even states in there of his Mila has disclosed multiple times sexual abuse by her father and multiple men that her father brings her to, including his own attorney. She was almost killed after a weekend-long visit with her father and his attorney. Those charges ended up being dropped on them. They gave her a lethal dose of meth when she was just a little girl. I believe she was only 3 years old. Mila, at this point, this all started when she was two. She's now just turned seven a couple months ago. Her mother has been chased out of the state of Maine. She has an active arrest warrant if she were to step foot into the state of Maine. She's been erased from her daughter's life, but bless her heart, she continues screaming for her, and she won't stop. And that's just another case. And then I know of another case here, and I can go on and on, but I want to give this just this last one here in the state of Maine, where there is a level 3 convicted child sex offender. Now, a level 3 is the worst of the worst. These are the ones that you are not going to rehabilitate. These are the ones who pose the most danger to our children in society. This level 3 convicted child sex offender is being allowed by a judge here in the state of Maine to not put under his registration, under his sex offender registry, that he cannot be around children under the age of 16, and he is currently around children, even overnight, with a 9-year-old little girl. And nobody can do anything about it. And the last thing, just before you kind of say anything, Tanis, is I want to draw attention. There was an event tonight created for this radio show. And anybody can find it on my personal Facebook page. It's for the Giving Children Hope show tonight. In that event, I did put up Mila's a brief story for Mila. And I did put up a brief story for three other children named Dakota, Austin, and Alia. Alia, 2 days ago, turned 11 years old. Dakota, Austin, and Alia were kidnapped by their father. All three children suffered a very suspicious metal poisoning a few months ago, and Alia has been missing since. No, her brothers don't even mention her or talk about her. So there's concern, is she alive? There is a court hearing tomorrow for this case, and it's in Northampton, Pennsylvania. So if anybody is listening, anybody can look into the event page for this Giving Children Hope show tonight, and they can help, you know, call that courthouse, pack that courthouse. It's an emergency petition by her mother, Lynn Lombardozzi, with the father. He will be there tomorrow, too. And we want to know where this child is. We want to know how she is and if she's alive. And we want them, please look into the case. There's multiple, or I should say mountains of evidence regarding this case and the danger that this man poses to these children who he has in his sole custody. So anyway, I just wanted to mention those two real quick. But Tanis, do you want to add in about how this affects the rights of our children?
Yes, I mean, you couldn't have summed it up better, Donna. It's completely terrifying reality for so many children and mothers primarily. I mean, there are some fathers, but we are focusing mainly on these extreme custody cases where these outcomes are happening in about 3.8%. The research, the documented research shows, so people are saying, oh, well, you know, I know fathers who've been alienated or mothers who've been alienated and so forth. So these extreme cases that Donna is talking about, Mary Goldstein and others have done some very comprehensive research over, you know, documenting, looking into the cases over 20 years, and they've come up to about 4% of the custody cases. So that doesn't sound like a lot, but when you think of how many divorces there are all over the world in first world countries, this 4% in pretty well every family court, in every state, in every province, every city, in each country where there's family courts, this, we're talking very, very likely a million children that, that have these extreme cases, extreme outcomes, where they are cut off, isolated, and from the loving, protected parent. In most of these cases, it's their mothers, and never see their mothers again. Like, in terms of never have hope of having their mothers back in their life during the rest of their childhood. What is so remarkable about this reality that is being covered up and has been covered up for over 20 years now. This has been going on in family courts. One of the things is the reason why nobody can do anything, or nobody in political positions, government positions, most lawyers, and we have a lawyer on the call tonight who as a guest, and she'll be talking about her experience, but most lawyers will not go the extra mile for these cases, will not defend the children, will not defend the mothers. They get spooked because they're up against such a force of opposition. And then all the other people, like the players involved, that just enforce these court orders say, well, you know, we just have to enforce the law. This is the law. We have to obey the law. And we can just think to other situations and other times in history, like the Holocaust. Hitler passed 400 laws to make everything he did legal in that government during that time. So if people do not analyze and question these laws and go, what is going on here, that... Not only, okay, so even if we're saying there's no proof of the abuse, right, of the domestic violence or the child abuse that children disclose, even if without proof, the very fact that these children never get their loving, protective parent, their moms back, their maternal families back, that they're cut off from also, is indication that something's amiss, especially since many of these mothers are accused of parental alienation. So then they're alienated in return as punishment for sometimes like 5 times, 10 times as long as what they were accused of alienating the father for in the first place. So that in itself, legal logic-wise, doesn't make any sense. And then even on the even looking at the rights of human rights, constitutional rights. I mean, we have different constitutions in our countries, in Canada and the U.S., but the constitutional rights are similar to the U.N. Declaration of Human Rights, and then there's civil rights, civil liberties. All of these across the board are being denied to the loving parents, their family, the children's loving family members that don't see the children for years often or under strict supervision, and to the children right up until they're 18 years old. This is unbelievable that this human cruelty, this inhumanity could be happening under the color of law, under the name of law, under the guise of law, whatever, because even without proof of the stuff that Dawn is talking about, the fact that they keep these children from family the children want to be with, that's my big issue, that the children never get family they love back, and that is just absolutely wrong.
Yep, exactly. And I just wanted to add a couple of things to what you said. The first part, you had said up to 18 years old. That's in some cases typically what happens, because the child is just left in their abuser's home in arms for years. I mean, we're talking some children are kidnapped very early on, and the loving parent was erased out of their life for years. So by the time they turn 18, they have such hopelessness and have become such programmed robots almost. Some people call it Stockholm Syndrome, but it's, they'll have the anger towards the loving parent because they didn't understand what happened. They didn't know that that parent screamed and fought and put their life on the line basically to try to help, you know, save them. There's many reasons that the child may not return after 18 years old. Again, I want to just kind of say this leads to what happens in our society. You know, all of this that's happening, and I don't even think that 4% is correct, because I saw a lot of it here in the state of Maine. There's a lot of corruption, a lot of people involved, and it goes all the way up through high-ranking officials that refuse to do things, to do anything to help her. Anyway, I just want to say, this is another part of it. Is there a typical loving parent? You can just call that person a whistleblower, because every parent that is had a child kidnapped that we're describing in our family law courts because of criminal elements of divorce or sexual abuse, child sexual abuse, child physical abuse, they're going to have a mountain of evidence. And they're going to be able to, if even just the one person that would sit and listen to them for one moment, they would be able to go through a mountain of evidence to show them, you know, just how this corruption happened. The problem is all of us end up forcefully silenced. Our children the worst, because as I described what they're going through for years and what conditions they're living in if they survive. But even the protected parent gets silenced, and in many different ways. You lose your family, your friends, and for whatever reason. You can't even begin to imagine or understand what this kidnapping can be like for them, but you lose them because they don't know what to say. They don't know how to help. So you're silenced that way because they don't understand. Unless you're in it, you don't understand it. You get silenced in that form as well because you feel like you're alone. No one's going to understand what happened, and if they do, no one's going to believe you. And then what's the next thing that happened? If someone did believe you and they went to the courthouse and they read that judge's court order, they're not going to see the evidence. The evidence was buried. They're going to believe the judge's court order, and that judge's court order sits on top. And it's the first thing that anybody would see that would even think to believe you. And once they're through reading that judge's court order where that judge just hammered on you and made the abuser the golden parent, they're going to just walk away thinking you're just as crazy. So you're left alone in silence that way as well. Another part that you touched on about family and the family losing out, it's so true. That's another part where I just can't even myself begin to imagine my own family and what this has done to them. Matthew and Donovan, our family is very, very close, and we always have been. And their grandfather, he's my stepfather. Right now he's actively dying. You know, he's been given 2 to 6 months to live. And not only do my sons, if they're alive, they don't know, and I'm not able to tell them myself and hug them and comfort them while I'm telling them about how sick Grandpa Don is, but then they're not even going to be able to be with him. You know, so it leaves the families completely torn apart, devastated. It leaves the protective parent isolated and alone. It leaves the children completely isolated and imprisoned in all of their freedoms and their rights, even just as a human being, are taken away. This is destruction among our families and our societies. We have criminals living among us, and it's been going on for generations. This is just something that... so out of control. It's a pandemic. It's widespread throughout our countries. There are countries of loving parents that are screaming about this at this point. you know, saying this is happening to them. It's the same type of protocol.
I just like to add what you're describing and what all the mothers that are listening in can relate to, and I mean some fathers, the defamatory, stigmatizing, casting women in the false light. And that's part of why many of these women, many of us women, are professionals, middle class. Connie and Karen talked about that in one of the shows. Lori, one of the moms that you mentioned, whose daughter is in a very dangerous situation. She has a PhD. Dawn and I have masters in social work, clinical social work. And so the fact that we are being stigmatized and defamed and cast in a false light, I mean, that also brings ruin in terms of just socially and professionally and financially, and it's on every level. So not only the destruction of our, you know, just our hearts on the ground, it's a pervasive destruction of everything that we nurtured in our lives and bringing babies into the world through our bodies, through our biology. This is actually biological warfare, to rip children from mothers who love them and terminate them from their child's life. It's, you know, we talk about the women's rights over their bodies. Well, this full biological expression of our bodies to bring new life into the world, to nurture and love our babies, and then to be ripped away from them and have absolutely no connection with them for years, or it's unreal that this could be happening in 2014 in the magnitude that it is in first world countries, where they look at other countries and, you know, news, mainstream media that will not touch this, look at other countries and go, look at the way women are treated, and they are treated awful in other countries, look at the way children are treated, but nobody is us women are giving voice to it, but in terms of mainstream acknowledgement of this and government acknowledgement of this, even the UN, I don't know if they're going to acknowledge the magnitude of this issue. We're talking at least 1 million children, many of them many of them are probably on the 1 million digital evidence images of child pornography in the special unit of the police, ICE, that they can't find. They can't locate these babies and toddlers and children under 8 years of age. They're mostly white kids being raped and tortured sexually in their own homes. I mean, why can't they find those kids? Do you think those moms are not reporting them? So there's a correlation there, and nobody is putting these things together. It's horrifying. It's absolutely horrifying that this is going on, and nothing's being done to stop it. And like Donna said, there's all kinds of evidence, and the court orders precede the mothers everywhere they go. They're in the schools of where their children are. They're in the medical offices. They're in the police stations. They're in the child protective services. They're everywhere the mother would go to maybe get help there. And the court orders are saying, defining who we are. And one of the things about the feminist movement in the 70s was, you know, our stories, like defining what we've lived, acknowledging our truth, you know, what we experience in our life. And this is how our voices have been completely canceled out. And the gift of who we are as mothers, our children aren't receiving that. They're not benefiting from that. They're not getting any of all the love and nurturing and care from their mothers. This is with all the animal rights activists, it's unbelievable that nobody's been speaking up outside of the mothers themselves, like so few people. And we're so grateful when a lawyer like Michelle, who's going to be, we're going to give it over to you to talk about your experience, but we're so grateful for the few strong people that have come forward with a backbone, that have some courage to start standing up to this, because most, even the good people, won't give voice to it, won't give credence to this horrific human rights violation. And I just want to add one more thing from Canada. I'm not sure how great this problem was in the States, but decades of First Nations children were sent by government policy, by the law, to residential schools. Those children, not all of them were sexually abused, many of them were, but, you know, they were emotionally tortured. They were segregated for years, often from 7 years on. Some got to come home in the summer, but, you know, they had to be sent back, and their mothers, just like many of us, were threatened, and fathers and grandparents and family members were threatened with prison if they didn't turn their children over. And that's what, another thing they're doing to further stigmatize and cast women in a false light, arresting, criminalizing, incarcerating, so giving women criminal records for just reaching out to their child.
Yeah.
After being really cut off and barred from any contact.
Right, exactly. I just want to say I've had a unique opportunity because I've actually been able to work in the state of Maine as a guardian ad litem, a rostered guardian ad litem in family law and child protective cases. I was blessed to be able to do it in multiple counties, almost all the way through the state, and I was blessed to be able to do it for years. In that experience alone, I should add also, God blessed me with the fact that as the owner of Hands On Parenting, I was able to, that's a statewide parenting, education, and advocacy and support, and it was mainly to battle this. And I was blessed in my law courts. I was blessed to do that and have this, I still have this business, and from tip to tip in the state of Maine. Now, by saying this, my experience has been that this is not a gender issue. It affects whether you are a mother or whether you are a father. I do think that when I've had that unique opportunity to see it and see it out in the community and see what happens. And so when someone says this is a mother issue, this is an attack on mothers, I need to immediately stand up and remind people I've seen it, except I've seen it worse for the fathers. The fathers get, I've already explained mainly what happens to a loving parent, a protective parent, but the fathers, because of their reasons and the stigma within society, they are attacked even worse. And I can't even imagine what life would be like in their shoes, given what their roles are to be meant to be here on this earth, and that's just completely stripped of them. This can happen to anybody, a man or a woman, a mother, a father, a grandfather, a foster mother, a foster father, an uncle. It can happen to anybody. It is not gender neutral. It's not discriminatory of anyone. It can happen. There are judges even that lose custody of their children if their ex has the right connections. There are lawyers.
Hey, Donna.
There are guardian ad litems. Hold on one second. This does not discriminate against one single person. I want to make that very clear. Because there's another part that people say, well, the father's rights groups have billions of dollars that they're investing in this, and the mothers have nothing. And I say to that, look at how much our children have. I don't care. I want the mothers and the fathers, the uncles, the brothers, the sisters, the grandmothers, the best friends, the family friends. I want everybody to take a stand together and everybody to fight this together and everybody to recognize who the ones are that we need to fight for and keep them in the forefront of our minds. Yes, Stephen?
Michelle and Sandra, they were wondering, they thought this was supposed to be only a one-hour show.
I say we're going to use the first hour to really, really nail this, what it is. We're actually, Sam and Michelle, we're just about to get to you because I wanted to cover that, what Tanis had said about the mainstream media and then the arrest warrants, and then have you kind of take it, Sam, if you don't mind.
Me take it, Donna. Why don't you answer some questions? Michelle's ready to talk.
Okay, she's ready to talk?
Michelle is ready to talk.
Oh, I love you, Michelle. Just let me add this about the mainstream media, because we kind of touched on it earlier, and you can touch on it a little more. They're silenced for whatever reasons as well, and I do see that that's a huge issue, but I want to recognize all of the ones that are actually trying to do something, the ones that are running local stations. You know, I believe it's ABC News in Atlanta, different stations that are trying, and I'm just going to push for more of that, because we cannot have any more silence. And then the arrest warrants, and trying to criminalize the protective parent, the loving parent. Sam, I kind of want to talk about your situation now and pull you in, and I hope now is a good time, and Michelle, for you as well. Sam, if you can kind of tell people what your living condition is and start with there, and then I really want them to hear where your children are right now.
As for my living conditions, I've been homeless since September 7th of 2012. I pretty much stay wherever I can, any place that's semi-warm and safe. I've stayed in multiple different places to sleep for the night. Some have been public, some have been private. As for my children, two of my girls have had to leave from the abuse. And my other three children, I have no idea where they are. As well as the other two. I don't know where they are either. I don't know where any of my five children are. It's been 517 days since I've seen any of my children. I've been told that's something. Go ahead, Don.
Hi, are you there?
Yes.
Can you hear us?
Yep, I can hear you. What I wanted to do was, you just mentioned that your two oldest girls have run away.
Yes.
Can you talk about what happened? Like, when Michelle came on board and what happened?
Well, Michelle, like to speak on this part.
Okay, go ahead, Michelle.
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for this show. You're using words like abuse, violence, threats, child abuse, loving parent, protective parent, dangerous, destruction, devastation, abusive, and I we're going to explain to you what those words mean in Sandra's case, because when you use words like that, that without describing what I call the act, what took place, they're pretty meaningless, and they become meaningless to courts, and that's the problem. If we are crying out to court saying, I'm an abuse victim, they say, and somebody's saying, I'm not an abuse victim, and the judge decides, are you an abuse victim or are you not an abuse victim? And we're talking about, there's nothing talking about it. The details of Sandra's case is what is important, and you know, the fact that she's homeless and right now, why is that? And I've always said courts should have the ability to undo injustices as readily as they inflict them. You know, Sandra for 17 years lived in the same home, raised her five children in that home for 14 of those years, same house, same school system, same churches, same doctors, and on September 7th, 2012, 517 days ago, a judge ordered her without a hearing to leave the home, abandon her children there, or she would be incarcerated, and she was to have no contact with them by third party, even. No contact at their schools, no contact through any of their caretakers. So that order and situation has remained in place for 517 days.
That temporary order.
Yeah, it was temporary.
And the children are to be given to whoever the guardian picked.
And it could have been the mailman. It's just whoever she picked. There was no specific person. Whoever she decided to
pick. And there was no, another thing, there was no...
Allegations?
Allegations. There was no... When you read the order, you can't figure out the reasoning behind it. And that's why use of these vague, generalized words, it needs to stop.
Yeah.
The only piece I heard when I was listening to the show was metal poisoning. That got my attention. Okay. And then I heard mountains of evidence. I didn't hear one piece of evidence. I just heard metal poisoning. So we have to stop just using the words, and we have to start describing the event blow by blow.
Just so you know, Michelle, that's not what the show is. We all the mothers have described abuse that are in these situations, or the parents, blow by blow. It's in the court records. It's things women have written. It's more we're talking about a systemic issue. And yeah, it's this is good to break it down with Sam and yourself, but we understand that. I mean, most of the women that are listening that have encountered this, and I know Donna would include the fathers and so forth, but I mean, that is exactly what the acts have been described, the acts that have been written. There's medical evidence, but because we're talking of magnitude of hundreds of thousands of children, right? We're talking about it systemically. It's not like these are meaningless words. They're backed up in each individual case. And you specifically can be talking about, you know, that's very helpful because we have you.
I just want to say that's what's being brought before the court, the details. We see the judges as they're the problem. They're the systemic problem because they're not looking at evidence. They're looking at what people write in affidavits. I've seen evidence just the other day of a judge ordered a domestic abuse. And of course I'm cynical, you know, because I see domestic abuse can be as minimal as I looked at you funny to I beat the heck out of somebody, you know, and they had bruises. And so there's this range. So if we just call it abuse, we don't get to the detail. But this poor, you said grandmothers, you know, this poor mother, grandmother, her own son wrote on her house the word whore, spray painted, and put a penis symbol, and was writing emails to her saying, you know, that he was going to, if she didn't leave the Catholic Church with the issue, she was going to pay, and very harsh, harsh language. And when she called the police said, go get a domestic abuse order. They wouldn't even file a report. So when she went to her therapist, the therapist said, are you kidding me? The police didn't take a report? And they called the police right then and there, and the police took a report. That is a crime. This is criminal activity that we, like you were saying, and it was beauteous how you phrased it, we're allowing criminal activity to occur because the police are passing it off to the family courts. They're passing it off saying, well, just go get an order for protection. That order for protection, at least in Minnesota, is a quasi-criminal proceeding. I am of the firm belief there is not such a thing as quasi-criminal. It's either civil or it's criminal.
That's exactly it. That's what I'm saying. This, we're
for our children's sake, we're being forced to go into a family law court when this is criminal in nature. This should be in our criminal courts. But
yes.
Sam, your children, I remember watching a video, and I was listening to your daughter. She was describing in detail an incident of, I can't remember if it was the one with her father was holding the handgun to her head at the table, or if it was the one that she was talking about when he grabbed her, threw her down on the couch and was strangling her, was choking her. And I remember hearing the terror in her voice. And the next thing I knew, because you and I have known each other a while now, the next thing I knew, your children are gone. They ran away. Can you kind of talk about, like, what led up to him getting ordered into custody? You and I have talked on how both of our kidnappings were premeditated. Mine were premeditated through a year earlier, him accessing and illegally tapping into my cell phone records, him and his attorney. And so up to a year before he was ordered, our children were ordered into his sole custody. He was trying to, he was accessing those and planning and premeditating the kidnapping. And you have, you would, if you don't mind, do you mind sharing a little bit about that stuff as well?
If you're referring to the fact that my ex-husband and I, my former husband, we had finally agreed on divorce. He finally agreed to give me a divorce. So we had determined the terms and all that. It was a done deal. I was divorced for months. I had 100% legal and sole custody. After a few months, my ex went back to the courts and tried to reopen it. And that's what he was able to do just by asking it to be reopened. And so within a year after that, here I am with 100% sole and legal custody. I'm being thrown out of my house, which was turned over. We had four homes. All four homes were turned over to my ex-husband, as well as all the property, all the cars, all the boats, whatever, as well as my children. We were talking about the kids. Yeah, my kids did testify to the abuse. They gave the facts. They gave the facts to the judge. The judge was in front of Michelle, made it very clear to the children that he didn't care what they wanted. They were going to do as he said. I am in more sympathy for my babies that are in my former husband's custody. So.
Yeah, I'd be very concerned as well, because I believe your daughter was extremely clear about that, as were all your children, that he held a gun to all of their heads.
Well, I don't know that that was what happened.
Okay.
I really would like Sandra to, and it's difficult to think back to that day when and say as clearly as she can what happened around the kitchen table. What I heard in court was that Sandra said that he sat around the kitchen table with his family and said he had was going to had a bullet for each of them, something to that effect. What their father said was that no, I sat around the kitchen table and I said I was going to kill myself. I don't know which is worse, but maybe Sandra can get into more of the details because she was a witness to it.
Go ahead, Sandra, because I think what I'm trying to get to is for people to understand why your two oldest baby girls are somewhere out on the streets versus being in court ordered into this abusive home, and why you were so terrified for your younger three.
They were not court ordered into the strange thing about this case was the parents both received no contact. Sam was removed from her home. She was seized from her home, and the kids were the idea was that they were just going to be there with a third party non-parent. And this person was not even in the action. So it was testified to that the kids just skedaddled. They went to the police at that moment, and that was 517 days ago. Since there was no communication, we don't have detail on what transpired with them. Sandra had two supervised visits. I was able to see one of those visits at the mall. And I wasn't the supervisor, though. And when I became involved, I asked that day, the first day I was at the hearing, to making a constitutional challenge to our statute. And I love what you said also about statutes. You know, civil rights violations. I am convinced that our statute that's convoluted and long and can be interpreted like Shakespeare is unconstitutional as written as applied. In any event, I made that argument, and I also asked that the children be interviewed in chambers. So all five of the children, and they had it set up where they had never been in therapy, but this court-ordered therapist, who we learned only saw the children four times, right?
Three times,
something like that, was in there and had them reading to the judge what their, you know, their statements. And they went in separately. And I think it was the saddest thing you would ever want to see. Sad because Sandra was crying. Sad because it was the saddest thing. And each child was practically begging the court for some assistance. Like, just what did you do to this family is what I heard. What did you do to us? Why are we, let us go home.
They were not asking to go back to their father. They were asking to go back to their mother. They did not ask to be with their father. They asked to be with their mother. They asked to go back home and live with their mother like they had been since the divorce happened.
Mm-hmm.
So they weren't asking for their family to be back together.
And it's about the judge. The judge actually said, you gotta understand, they were not with either parent at this point. So they were just wanting to go back to their mother. The oldest boy, you could tell that he felt, oh, I'm here, there's a judge, he has a robe on, you know, whatever you want, Your Honor, you know, my parents must have done something, I'll do whatever you say, kind of a thing. But with each child, the judge got more coercive. It's hard to explain. You will follow my orders. Now, the children aren't court ordered to do anything. You will do as I say. It was that kind of coercion. And when we left, I quickly ordered the transcript and was going to get it, according to the clerk. She was preparing it for me. And when I went to pick it up, I called her, and as I'm there at the clerk's office, an order comes down on our Mensis program that it was sealed.
By the judge,
and it's been sealed ever since, and the unsealing is what I brought to the United States Supreme Court. It's still a seal. I did a motion to unseal. It's the cover-up. So to speak.
Right. That you brought up a good point.
And I have to say, I continue to blame this judge. This judge, there's no such thing as, had never had evidence of anything. Evidence to me is when somebody, in court, if somebody actually is testifying, sitting on a stand, subject to cross-examination, the only evidence he had is when he examined the children in that conference room. The only trial that took place was the one where I participated in, called a custody trial, if you could call it that. You can see evidence of abuse. It's there. What's happening in our courts is that
the courts become the obstacles to the evidence. I can't explain it. You see what I, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's
they become obstacles to real evidence, and that's what, how the victims get creamed, because there's never any real, yet even these orders for protection, I would never, if my client was truly abused, that is just a piece of paper. It's not very helpful. And I can't even in this culture say that you could go into court and the court's going to give you that order for protection. Because if it's being defended by an attorney, and I've seen this happen, who's being paid money to explain how the abused victim abused the abuser, which I've seen happen, then it would just get dismissed. So the true victims are never heard.
Nope, never. You brought up a good point talking about the cover-up. In this type of a kidnapping, a custody kidnapping, a trafficking, in order to cover up, they seal records, they seal tapes, and they issue gag orders. And then anybody that violates them faces some sort of imprisonment or arrest warrant. Like, Sam, don't you I recently had an arrest warrant out for me for hugging my son when I saw him in public. Under 2 minutes of threats and duress, after not even knowing if he was alive for almost a year and a half, but which is part of the criminalization. But can you talk a little bit about your situation, like what we were talking about earlier, where you cannot stay in one place longer than 48 hours?
Well, what happened, and it's the fear.
Right.
The fear of, you know, there was an order that said subject to incarceration. That order is still in the file. So that you have the fear, and then what's sitting in the file since September 12th of last year is a proposed order that her former husband filed. That is, I've never seen anything like it in 26 years of family law. It says civil arrest warrant, and it has David Knudsen's name on the bottom, ready to be signed. In the file, and it was because on September 11th, when she testified, she was asked where she lived, and she said, I don't live anywhere. I do not have a home. So the other attorney used this as the one, you know, to say that she's supposed to be providing her address, and the actual order said residence to the former husband. It doesn't say anything about residence to the court. And filed it. Now, we never get this is the problem with this particular judge. So he can choose to sign that at any time. He hasn't admonished the other attorney for even filing it. It's just sitting there.
You bring up
the waiting to be signed. And we've tried to have this judge removed twice recently to no avail. He is staying on the case. It's been compared to when somebody might embezzle and they're going to, you know, they never leave their job because they don't want to get caught.
Right. You bring up a really good point too. That fear, because that fear is instilled to the point of such silence that you know, it does keep a protective parent, a loving parent, from fighting as full force as they might for the child. Even that does happen. They risk you know, maybe outcast more in society, or reputation, or they're worried that their children might be embarrassed if their names are used, or there's a certain level of fear out of all of this. And going back to the arrest warrant, whether it gets signed or not, I too, even though the district attorney in Kennebec County dropped the charge for hugging my son, On that same day, almost a month ago tomorrow, that same day, my ex-husband came up with another possible charge and was asking for another possible arrest warrant, and she decided to let that sit on her desk. In a file, which it is right now. I don't even know what it's for. And if any more information or so-called evidence comes in from my ex-husband or anybody that he knows that he has caller and asked for at any time, she'll sign that arrest warrant, and that goes up for the next 3 years. So for the next 3 years, I have that hanging over me that they can come arrest me at any moment. Just like Sam. Sam, you're right now.
And that is, I used to, in years past, blame the lawyers. And then I started to say, well, it's the information that the litigants, the people are giving to their lawyer to give to the judge. And now, without hesitation, I blame the judge.
Right, so right now, Judge Kennedy.
Without hesitation, because we have this adversary process. So what's the lawyer supposed to do? What are the people supposed to do? They're trying to defend an allegation of abuse. So what's the best defense? A good offense, whether it's true or not.
Right. And right now, Sam, if you don't mind me asking you, right now the arrest warrant that's not signed, but that is sitting there on Judge David Knudsen's desk for you, is if you set up residence, and residence is defined as staying any place more than 48 hours. So I can't even imagine. I mean, you must be going from home to home, and only with what's on your back, and I can't even imagine friends and family. I mean, what's it been like for you?
The family is included in the no contact, so that includes all my siblings. Also, any prior friends that I had prior to September 7th. So I can't have any contact with anybody that knew my children prior to September 7th.
The judge ordered you not to have any contact with any family or friends.
It's siblings of anybody, siblings or people, friends that have had any contact with my children prior to September 7th. So everybody that I have had to meet and live with and stay with are people that have never met my met my children. So these are all new people that I'm meeting that have to take me in.
You can only imagine the stretch of saying, oh, she violated the no contact order by saying that she didn't have an address.
Damn, I can't even imagine.
You can only imagine how perfect this woman is. You know, the fear that she would testify in court that she doesn't have an address, and she said, where did you sleep last night? She said, I didn't. The fear that if that gets you the other attorney to file a warrant,
explain why.
What exactly, and she's asking me to explain why she said she didn't sleep, because we were up all night, her and I, she was at my office, filing, which was filed on September 11th, our U.S. federal civil rights action.
So, and what Michelle's trying to say is I was telling them the truth. I hadn't slept the night before. We were up all night working, and the judge became very upset about it and retaliated in the courtroom. He was very upset and basically accused of, or me, of being untruthful. And yet I was telling him exactly what I had done. So, I mean, this is kind of what I'm dealing with. But, Donna, you keep asking, yes,
and this is what, we gotta mention this. This is with, in another county, she had filed, and it was pending, a harassment restraining order. We had the stalking, from her former husband. So she was allegedly, I guess, court ordered, to provide her address to her former husband, and he knew, without a doubt, that there was a pending harassment restraining order. So we went from court on Thursday to a hearing on Monday that I told Sandra, and her former husband showed up, and so did the attorney. I said, Sandra, you can't go to that hearing. And, of course, because she wasn't there and I was there, that judge, who might have understood, had no choice but to dismiss it because the petitioner wasn't there.
But I wasn't there because I had a pending arrest warrant for civil. You know.
And legally, you know, this is how mixed up, or how, I guess, malicious or manipulative a judge can be, or another lawyer. All it is, and it's still there, a piece of paper with a line that he could sign at any moment, sitting in the file. You can go look at the file now, waiting to be signed, that will be an arrest warrant, a civil arrest warrant, which I had never heard of or seen.
For being homeless.
It was made up, it was conjured up by the other attorney.
So, Donna, when you ask why I stay at a different place every 48 hours, a lot of times there's not places I can go. A lot of people are so afraid of this judge and what he's going to do to them. They don't want me at their place for more than 24 to 48 hours. So sometimes it's not by choice. And that's not that they're trying to be mean. They just are afraid of what this judge will do. I mean, there's other issues that I'm not going to get into them, of the fear of their family due to somebody that appears to be stalking them. I mean, I'm being followed.
And like you said, Donna, or maybe this was Candace, you don't know it until you experience it. You have, you don't know it till you experience it. This is a systemic problem. It is, it's unstoppable. How do you stop it? Only with shows like this, where you're getting the word out, so to speak, where people are actually going to hear about it and say, this can't happen in real life. I really don't think the public right now is ready to hear what happened to Sandra. They just think she must have done something. Her attorney must have done something. Why would this happen to anybody? Her case is the most severe case I ever witnessed.
Maybe, Michelle, I mean, I'm sitting here and it's happened, you know, I've been segregated from my children for almost 5 years and I have done nothing wrong, basically, and there is a criminal charge pending on me for encountering my child on the street for a couple minutes. I was reported on by somebody at the supervisory center, and the Crown Attorney here in Canada, under the Attorney General, will not drop this charge. They will not stay it. And meanwhile, in all these cases, evidence is ignored of abuse, domestic abuse, child abuse, and yet our encountering our own flesh and blood offspring for any situations, we're then, you know, further persecuted, like you're describing here with Sam. Sam's describing Donna for the most normal things when we're given the most abnormal court orders that people are still deferring to without question. And I agree with you. I'm sitting here listening to the things you're saying about Sam, and if you weren't on here as a lawyer, and for anybody that hasn't gone through this, they'd go, that doesn't make any sense. There's no way that could happen. There's something she's not telling us, right? This type of, it's insanity, actually. And we're supposed to act like it's normal. They label us as insane for going, this is unacceptable, this is wrong.
Yeah, what you're describing to me is heartbreaking, and the liberties with our children are being taken away by courts, okay? So we're getting to who's responsible for this. It isn't your former husband. It isn't the former husband's attorney. It isn't you. It's the courts. Our liberties with our children are being taken away by the courts to one degree or another.
That's right. That's right. I see I focus much more on the courts myself when I talk about this, because and the people that have the authority now, like politicians, government leaders, and here they're called crown attorneys, there they're district attorneys, all the lawyers, like, can you imagine this still continuing, Michelle, if more lawyers stood up like you are? No. At some point, the bad apples, the judges that are getting away with sheer tyranny, dictatorship, treating us like we're slaves to masters, you're going to obey me, regardless of if it makes any sense, whether it strips you of all your civil liberties, whether I'm denying your human and constitutional rights, it doesn't matter, you're obeying me.
Tanis, you hit the nail on the head. Once again, it's about our liberties. And when we talk about if we're going to continue to make it a man versus woman or a father versus a mother situation, we have to say, yes, there are parents that commit acts of abuse towards their children, towards their spouse or loved ones. But when that is brought to a court, why are we not addressing it? It's because it's because the judges are not addressing.
That's right.
And I told you, I mean, I've had thousands and thousands of cases over the years. One recent one was where a parent, 50-50 custody, and they can go on, this was 10 years ago, they got 50-50 custody, still have parenting consultants and whatnot, had an argument with one of his children about a chess game. And the child went and stayed with the mother and stayed there. And he, of course, wanted to see his child. And he, when he went there, police were called, and then she asked for her harassment restraining order, got the restraining order. And then when he asked for contempt because the restraining order was just on the mother, no abuse, no allegations of abuse, you know, no details. His parenting time with that one child was suspended. Now, this was at a point where he hadn't seen the child for 4 months and was going to the court for relief. You see, we should be going to courts to when our liberties with our children are being restricted. When we are deprived of our children, that's when we should go to court, not to go to court to get deprived of our children, but to actually bless some order that deprives us of children.
That's right. If there's no abuse, there is absolutely no way in any of these cases. I mean, this has been my mission. The whole thing is there is no way a parent or a loving family member should be segregated from these children, you know, when there's no abuse or endangerment. This is a complete denial of all our rights and our children's rights to love, to be cared for, to be nurtured, to have a meaningful relationship with people in their family they love. It's unreal that this could be happening.
It's unreal, and we're doing it to each other, and then the courts are not providing justice. In any way, shape, or form, it's the antithesis of family justice when we go there most of the time, unless we both agree what we think justice is for our family. So it's very, very sad, and it needs to stop. I compare it to when I was telling Donna this earlier. I also have done adoptions all of these years, and I'm an adoptive parent myself. And I remember when we adopted our children, we were asked to, do we agree to provide them with a home, love and security, all the necessities of life, education, health care, love and companionship. Okay, and we agreed to that. So what we end up doing in one form or another when we break up is depriving a parent of love and companionship, that piece of support that's so vital.
Well, and depriving the child. The child is being deprived. I mean, here are these children of Sam's, My children were very clear. They wanted to live with me. Donna's sons, Sam's, I mean, they're not being listened to. Children know from a very young age, when there is a divorce too, they know where they feel more secure, more at home, where they want to be. Most children don't want to be divided in half. That's again, a third party entity deciding. Often, the judge in my case never met my sons. She's never laid eyes on them. In Sam's case, the judge met with them, but it's sealed. Why is it sealed? They made it very clear they wanted to live with their mom. Kids know. And what's wrong with that? What's wrong with them living primarily with the parent they feel more at home with or more comfortable with? And if there's no abuse, yes, the relationship can be nurtured to go, you know, where they see the other parent. But why is a third party entity? How did we get to this place, Michelle, where a third party entity like a judge, who whether they lay eyes on the children or not, can be deciding the rest of their life where they lay their little heads and go to bed every night until they're 18? I mean, it's absurd.
Here's how we
by
got
a court to, order.
Here's how we got to this place. I know the answer to your question. When we separate, we file with the court, and we say that we want you to determine custody, court. We want you to determine how we should divide our assets, and most of the time we say we want you to terminate our marriage. So, and then we even add the broad provision that for such other and just relief. So we are suing each other, plain and simple. And when you sue each other, you invite the third branch of the government into your lives. And if you don't agree they're in your lives, it's beyond 18. I know you mentioned 18. It's beyond 18 at this point.
And just so you know, Tana, that's the typical way, but in other situations like mine, our entire divorce was agreed upon. It was agreed that I would have 100% legal and sole custody. Everything was already pre-done, pre-written up. We didn't need anybody involved in our stuff.
So what you would think is that was a friendly lawsuit. 5.7 million domestic orders a year. And, you know, maybe 99% of them are agreed upon. But what I'm trying to explain, and this is what Family Innocence is all about, is that I think we understand that when we file a petition and serve it, whether it's friendly or not, we are inviting the third branch of the government into our lives, and we are creating for ourselves our own little laws, our own little injunction, so to speak. And when I talk about injunction, they go, well, that's not an injunction. Yes, it is. An injunction is an order that tells you what to do and what not to do. Now, isn't everybody's custody order telling them when they can see their kids, when they can't see their kids, how much money they have to pay or how much money they don't have to pay, what they have to do on a blow-by-blow basis? These we're pigeonholed into orders that are injunctions, and we ask for our liberties to be taken away. Is my point?
I want you to have an opportunity to talk about the Family Innocence Project and also the national lawsuit you're doing. But before you go into that, I just want to make a comment, because what you said is very true, and most people don't have any idea that that's how it's going to look in the end, and those court orders can be used like clubs over each other's lives. But the key piece that's really, really critical here is, let's say that 5%, it's somewhere between 5 and 10%, where it does involve domestic abuse of some form, right, including child abuse, where it's not possible to co-parent. I mean, Status of Women organizations have been writing about this. Research has shown that co-parenting is not the best interests of the children in situations where the marriage ended due to domestic abuse of any kind, including like very toxic emotional, psychological abuse. And it may, you know, there are acts like that, like what that son did to his mother and stuff like that. That wasn't, he didn't hit her. But so women go. And what's happened with the Divorce Act, I don't know when the Divorce Act passed in the States, but here it was 1985, women can no longer, and I'm going to use women because I'm not going to worry about everybody, right? Can no longer just protect their children. Because here the Divorce Act is presumptive joint custody. So without a court order, if a woman were to just basically say, you know, like the marriage is over, I'm just going to protect the children. They don't want to go. They're afraid because of the domestic abuse that they lived, they witnessed, even whether she called the police or not. The presumptive joint custody then can be used as, oh, she's not providing access, or she's kidnapped the kids if she moves to another jurisdiction, right? Then it becomes a criminal kidnapping, parental abduction, and so there is absolutely no way that a woman can proceed in just carrying on with her life with the children without the courts being involved. If the father, basically in these cases, wants to have access and the children don't want to go, they're pretty well forced to go, and then it becomes this ongoing state intervention, government, you know, third party court. You know, I call the judges government employees too, because they're paid by the government. I mean, that's part of it. Women are not allowed to just move forward and protect their children.
Yeah, we have that in terms of, I guess, we don't have presumptive, we have presumptive joint legal custody, which works well if you're a unmarried parent, an unmarried father, and want to be involved, but it doesn't work well when you get a final order, as in Sandra's case, that terminates your custodial rights. And when I say her rights were terminated, what I hear is, and this is from the courts, of course, well, that wasn't a termination of parental rights proceeding. We do that in juvenile court. Yes, her custodial rights were terminated, her physical custodial rights and her legal custodial rights. So let's call a spade a spade. She doesn't have liberties with her children at all. She can't visit with them. She can't go to their schools. So you actually have more rights outside of court before court gets involved than when court starts to get involved. In other words, by virtue of giving birth and being parents, you have a fundamental right, if you want to exercise it, to the care, custody, and control of your children. If you want to exercise it, is the key. And I think most that 5%, they're just angry about something not even related to the best interests of the children.
So what she's basically saying, Candace, is I have no legal or custodial rights to my children. So when she's saying call a spade a spade, I've been TPR'd.
That's right. No, I hear you. And what I'm saying is, I'm going back to what Michelle said, I don't either, neither does Donna. Nor do most of the women listening in probably on this program. But what I'm saying is, it's a catch-22, because what Michelle was saying, we give away our right to decide when we enter the courthouse. Well, we don't have any choice if there's abuse and the children don't want to go, and the father demands his rights. and then it's in the courts, and if the children aren't protected, there, it's taken out of the mother's hands instead of her being able to decide, okay, this isn't working for the children.
It should.
I think many women would not have bothered going to court.
If we had a speed bump, so to speak, and that speed bump was that, first of all, that courts are to protect our liberties, not to restrict them, meaning that if a parent was going to court because his liberties with his children were being restricted, which, and there wasn't an abusive act, there wasn't a situation where the children are afraid to go with the other parent because he said he'd kill himself with a gun or said he was going to shoot us, then that parent should have as much liberties with their children. That 5% where there's one abusive parent or another or both are abusive. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, exactly. The thing is...
So we have it twisted.
Right.
It is very twisted. If I can just jump in here for a second, it goes back to what I was saying at the beginning of this. These are different types of custody cases, and I almost want to take the word custody right out of there. We're talking about a divorce case versus a criminal case that are both held in a family law court. Child abuse and domestic violence are criminal. For whatever reason, we are forced to go in our family law courts for protection and safety for our children, and that's when they are given sole custody. The abusers are given sole custody of our children. It is never meant for the children to ever be heard. They're, even from the beginning, from the second that custody is paid for and bought so that criminal can avoid any and all legal punishment for whatever they've done, whatever violence or child abuse they have instilled, that child is never meant to be heard. Where you said this goes to the judges of the problem, you're absolutely right. This is something that has been going on for years. This is generational. These are people that they raise, train, educate, and then put into positions of power and authority to rule over the lives of our children. These are people that are hiding, as well as the parents, I already said, the criminals are hiding as parents. These judges are hiding as criminals because they're conspiring with them. It's something like, as in my case, it was premeditated at least up to a year ahead of time that I can prove. It's a business. If you think about it, over the years, yes, the divorce rate has gone up, but so has the amount of money that a person has to pay if they have children involved in order to get divorced and solidify the child custody agreements. It's lengthy. You're in court for years and years and years, and your child might even age out, and you're still going back to court for child support for whatever reason. This is a lucrative business within the walls of our family law courts that not one person is going to be aware of until they're smack dab in the middle of it. They've had to go to the court because of violence or child abuse or something criminal in nature, and their child was ripped away from them. And they have to fight the rest of their life or until the child ages out or comes back to them or something in order to have that child back in their life. In my mind, this is the severest form of child abuse, and the parent that destroys any and all rights, human rights to that child for the other parent, whether it's a loving mother or a loving father, that is the most serious abuse, the most devastating, emotionally harmful, mentally harmful type of abuse that you can do to a child to completely pull them away from a loving parent and force them to live with a dangerous, abusive, violent parent. And this is a business within the walls of our courts, and that is why we have this show. I want you, Michelle, if you don't mind, can you please tell us what the Family Innocence Project is?
Well, Family Innocence is a nonprofit dedicated to keeping families out of court and resolving conflicts and injustices peacefully. It came to me in February of 2011, and I mentioned this to you, Donna, just before Pope John Paul II was being beatified, that there was a call for miracles, because he needed a couple of miracles in order to be a saint. And I woke up one night, in the middle of the night, and I looked at my husband beside me, and I said, well, my family's real good, no issues there. And I thought, everybody's healthy. I thought, my business is doing well, my law business. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll ask for $1 million. Then I thought that was too selfish. And then it came to me, abolish family court in 1 year. And I stopped myself. I said, well, you know, I'm not going to do that. You know, this is not, what is this that you're calling a miracle? And within a couple of days, I was in court with a client of mine, Benedictus Ambuna, a black man from Kenya, Africa, and we were getting ready for his testimony. And his case was a grave injustice. He had no mother to argue with or fight with, because she was dead. And he went to the bus stop one day, and his child was gone. So an ex parte order with no allegations of abuse, his child was snatched in family court. Not domestic abuse court and not juvenile court. And I don't know what compelled me, but I said to him, do you know who Pope John Paul II is? And he said, yes, I was confirmed by him when I was a young boy in Kenya, Africa. He said, my mother was going to be a nun. My father was going to be a priest. Instead, they married, had 18 children. 9 of them were confirmed by Pope John Paul II when he was an archbishop and came to Kenya, Africa to do that. And I just thought to myself, I just had this prayer, and then now I'm meeting with Ben, and within a couple of weeks, we did get that on the record, by the way, in his testimony. Then and within a couple of weeks, I had a meeting at my home on March 1st of that year, and we started Family Innocence. I had meetings. There were 11 of my clients there or so. All of us had been struggling with this issue, and we've had meetings every first of the month since.
That's amazing, because you said it, if you're walking into the walls of our family law court, you're walking into their business, an organized business, an organized crime of child trafficking, you know, and buying our children's lives. So I, you know, it's almost, some people are say, what do we do about this? And there's a lot going on. You guys, you have the Supreme Court, which I want you to talk about that as well. But at this point, it's really letting people know what's happening. If you go into the family law courts, how we have criminals avoiding punishment and prosecution and hiding under a parent title, how our judges are really the problem, ignoring and hiding and covering up corruption and evidence of child abuse, and they're never held accountable. The rates of our children being killed at this point, and we're talking about young children, the rates in Florida and other states and all around the world, really is out of proportion. And it leads to this fact that our children are being court-ordered into the hands of abusers. The public is not aware of it. The public still lives under myths and stigmas. And the real criminals that are really hiding behind all this and never held accountable, never looked at again, no one ever thinks twice of, are the judges who signed that court order of that child's life, handing that child's life into the arms of a very dangerous person. They're never even looked at again. We've got true criminals hiding on benches, having power and authority over all of our lives, destroying all of our lives, especially our children, and then no one ever looks at them again. So
I would just
I would just like to temper that. I mean, not all the children are in extreme danger in these situations. However, all of them are being emotionally abused by this. These court orders themselves are a form of domestic abuse to give that much control over to a parent that they didn't want to live with. In these cases, usually they were forced to, and to take away the sustenance, the nurturing, the support, the love, the gifts of, I mean, in most of these extreme cases that have been researched are mothers. The maternal deprivation, that is emotionally devastating. And to think about how much children want their mommies, you know, or daddies, but, you know, more mommies, you know, mommy every day, and for years they can't even call out to their mom. I mean, they're going to bed crying at night if they get sick. They don't have their mommy to reach out to. You hear about these stories of soldiers dying, you know, adult men, you know, saying, calling out for their mom. And it's this the emotional vacuum that leaves, and there's no question that all these children are being harmed and injured through the emotional devastation and of these court orders, these extreme court orders, ruling good, loving family members out of their lives. So they're not all in total danger, but I'm just tempering it because they all are being emotionally harmed.
Right. What these orders do, and I call them injunctions because they don't change unless you go back to court and go through another process to try to have them change, is these orders take away what I call family innocence. They strip us from our day-to-day agreements that we make with the other parent because we're pigeonholed into a structure that is not realistic in a lot of cases.
Hey, Donna?
Yes?
I just wanted to say we only got about 4 minutes left.
Yeah, I do want to wrap up a little bit. There's so much to these cases, and the cases that I'm talking about are the cases where there is domestic violence and child abuse. It is very serious. The cases that I'm talking about, the loving parent not only fights for years and has mountains of evidence of corruption and cover-up and can be considered a whistleblower, but these are true organized crime cases within the walls of our family law court. I know we didn't really get a chance to talk about the Supreme Court that you guys are currently underway, which will set a legal precedence, but I want to just give people some contact information real quick, and I want to direct them to learn more about that, because it's a collaborative effort with Safe Kids International at this point. So is there contact information for you, Michelle, and then I can give contact information as well for anybody
yes.
that wants to know more about what it is you guys are doing right now in the lawsuit, the federal civil class action lawsuit.
I would have them check out www.familyinnocence.com, www.familyinnocence.com.
Okay. And also they can go to the Safe Kids International Facebook page for Sam's story and to get more information about the Supreme Court lawsuit that you have going at this point. I also want to say I've been trying to do outreach for, other protective parents all around the world. Tanis and I, we've kind of teamed up. I'm using my personal Facebook page, Donna Farris, F-A-R-R-I-S. Anyone and everyone can send me a friend request. I'm trying to reach out to any child out there. We have a Giving Children Hope Facebook page that any child can follow that page for these shows. These are weekly shows on Thursday night, and learn more about what we're doing to try and scream for your lives and for your safety. I do want to end this with a very quick scripture. I first want to say thank you, Michelle. Thank you, Sam, for coming on the show with us tonight, helping us to give all of our children a voice at this point.
Thank you so much. Donna and
thank you,
Janice. Yeah. I mean, you don't know how much this means to Sandra and I, and your show and what you're telling, you know, getting the word out. It's so important.
Thank you. I just thought you guys are so strong, and just stay strong, and let's be in this together. This is what it's going to take to end this form of corruption and this level of child abuse, is all of us getting to that together, all of us screaming together, all of us being willing to stand up and fight for the life of even one child, all of us learning as much as we can about what is going on in the courts. And just being there for each other and screaming for each other when we need each other, such as when I said earlier about the child that's missing. Her birthday was 2 days ago, and her mother has a court hearing tomorrow in Pennsylvania. People need to be at that. That can be found on my Facebook page wall or under the event for tonight. The more people that pack these courtrooms and scream for our children, or call the DAs or call the Supreme Court justices, the more we're going to scream for our children and give them a voice.
Can I add a couple things?
Yes.
We have a wonderful host that is quiet, but he is making this happen, Stephen Roberts, and we thank you for making this happen and taking on this issue. Without his understanding of the technology and all of this that he quietly does behind the scenes, this wouldn't be possible. And Stephen has taken on covering this issue through his networks. But he also does something very special for us, and that's producing an MP3. And this is a wonderful way for every woman, every protected parent, family member, to help each other get the link. The MP3 link for this that we'll post on Giving Children Hope, and send it out and send the archived ones out to the government offices, to the universities in your area, to people that you think need to be informed about this, because a lot of times people won't read it, but they'll listen to voices of people that are talking about it systemically. Michelle's a lawyer. She's given credence to this. So the MP3 is a wonderful way to spread it. So even though most people like that are not listening to this show, you can take the MP3 that Stephen produces, send it in an email link to all that you can get emails to addresses to all government politicians. I mean, they're public servants, and write your story with it and say, I'm just another example of this, what they're talking about on this program. And I would like to ask Michelle, I know we're going a little over, but I think it's very important, because I understand up here in Canada you're doing a national class action lawsuit, and I do think the family members listening, Michelle, if you can just touch on what that looks like for them, unless it's all explained on the Family Innocence website, but if you want to say just a little something about where you're at in that process and how many how many people you have on board and what you're looking at. I mean, maybe we need to get you on another show, you and Sam, but if you can say a little bit for the people that would like to contact you about that now and get on it as fast as they can.
That would be great. On September 11th, I filed a civil rights class action lawsuit based on the violation of civil rights relating to Sandra and her five children against Judge David Knudsen in his personal capacity, and Mary and John Doe's 1 through 20. We have filed it for Sandra and her family, but it's for all families similarly situated. And what that means is, the importance of that is that rather than take, I said 5.7 million, you said 5%, rather than taking each case separately, we get one case that is a symbol of what's happening to families in the Eighth Circuit and around the country. If we are successful in Sandra's case, all the family members will have to do is give us their damages. I repeat,
all the family members will have to do is give us their damages, or they will have the right to go and file their own class, their own civil rights lawsuits. So that this is the importance of her case. The team that we have, it's right here. Sandra's my co-counsel. This is it. I'm a sole practitioner, and so we're needing the support of other lawyers, professionals, and mostly individuals. When we you asked for the status, Tanis. When we went to court for our first hearing, which was a motion to dismiss by Judge David Knudsen in his individual capacity, there was standing room only. That was a beautiful thing. I made my argument. They let me talk for over an hour. And the Attorney General who was representing, our state's Attorney General, was representing the judge to dismiss it based on judicial immunities read from a script, pretty much. And we ended up, that issue is under advisement. We have a very realistic, we feel as if we win either way, but we want this case to go forward. It's a motion that they did is based on judicial immunities. Judges, the highest authority in the land, are immune, but our position is they are not immune from violating our constitutional and civil rights. In fact, they're obligated to defend and protect our constitutional and civil rights.
Exactly. So essentially, can women contact, can family members contact you to get on the class action lawsuit? Is that where you're at, receiving other people's injustice situations with a particular judge?
I would love to hear from them. We're not at that stage yet, and I'll tell you why. Do you remember the class action cigarette cases, you know, against the cigarette companies? There was only probably one person that died of cancer, or one person affected, and once that won against those companies, everybody could join it.
Is that how a class action works?
That's how a class action works. And I did take a course at Harvard Law on class actions, but my understanding is I just have to win and be successful with Sandra's case, and at that point, everybody meets with the same success if they are similarly situated, meaning that for 517 days ongoing or one day, their liberty with their children, they would just submit the damages.
How would you define damages in terms of monetary or emotional and psychological?
In civil cases, they're always monetary, and they're monetary. A criminal, of course, is for punishment. You go to jail. You might pay a fine. In civil cases, there's a payment of the damages. So the damages, for instance, there's a case where I believe a child was lost for one day, taken away for one day wrongly, and that damages was over $1 million for one day.
Wow.
All right, I think we have to
yes, we do. Yes.
Finishing up here. So we've got your information for people to reach out to you. Thank you again just for being so strong and so brave and being in this fight with us for all of our children. Thank you, Stephen. Tanis said it perfectly. I thank you and all the networks that are helping us. to really reach out to all of our children trapped in this and give them a voice and give them some hope. I want to just finish up with just a really quick scripture from John 4, 32-38. But he said unto them, I have meat to eat that ye know not of. Therefore said the disciples one to another, hath any man brought him aught to eat? Jesus saith unto them, my meat is to do the will of him that sent me, and to finish his work. Say not ye, there are yet 4 months, and then cometh harvest. Behold, I say unto you, lift up your eyes, and look on the fields, for they are white, red, already to harvest. And he that reapeth receiveth wages, and gathereth fruit unto life eternal, that both he that soweth and he that reapeth may rejoice together. And herein is that saying true, one soweth and another reapeth. I sent you to reap what whereon ye bestowed no labor. Other men labored, and ye are entered into their labors. I just want to end with that tonight. I think we did a good job with this show and really kind of spreading public awareness as to what's happening. And bless all of your hearts. This is going to take a lot of work, and it's going to take a lot of us being in this together. I feel very blessed to have met all of you. And thank you again, Sam and Michelle and Stephen and Pam.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone, for being on.
And thank you to everyone listening. Have a great night.
Yes, I wanted to say one last thing. We've got a brand new shiny donate button on Scotland is Free and People's Internet Radio. And we've had... It's only like 3 hours old, and we've had $200 donated to us already. So,
wow!
Just keep up the good work. Yes,
that's wonderful. And because Stephen, I just want to put a plug in for Stephen. How long have you been doing this for free? You have been given your time, your dedication, and even though you're often, you know, people don't hear your voice, you are the one that's putting this issue out all across the airwaves in North America. And I just thank you for that. And so remember that, people, because he's never asked for anything. And I don't know how long you've been doing Cancel the Cabal, Stephen. But
over a full year.
A whole year. And this is out of his heart that he's doing this, and it takes a lot of time. He's produced YouTubes and MP3s. So thank you to those people that are donating, because he's done all of this voluntarily, and so that's wonderful news.
Unbelievable. And thank you to, again, like Tana said, to those who are donating. Thank you to the Scotland is Free, the People's Internet Radio. This donation is important because we did have Charles Decker Jr. on the show last week talking about his Turn Up the Volume tour, and this is important. We need to get him on the road. We need to give our children voices. The number one people who have no money are our children. So just thank you and bless your hearts to every single one of you.
Yes, yes, and good night, ladies.
And good night. Thank you. Thank you, Michelle and Sam. Good night.
Yes, nice, Donna.
Thank you, guys.